former president are doing the best job. Probably one of the things that they have done, we think that they should have done, and I think they have done, was to make sure that he gets vaccinated before it got cold. Because they knew that his condition is not good enough, so they should have given him vaccine long before even. And I'm hoping this is what we must learn even ourselves. Those who are sick every year around even before it gets cold in South Africa, you should have vaccine, viral vaccine, antiviral vaccine, so that when it becomes cold, you don't have a problem. I think the second thing is that somebody who gets a current infection, sometimes they usually have what they call prophylaxis, and I'm hoping that those are some of the things that they've considered. But we're hoping that the old man is going to come out of it and be strong and be well. Today we were supposed to have Ugandan parliamentary members of parliament from Uganda, but unfortunately it seems as if they had problems with their passports, so they couldn't come, and they told us that they apologized because they couldn't come because of the problem of passports. So they are not here, and we ended up having a space, and we thought in that space we would look at our minutes. I'm sure everybody was given minutes, but I want to make a request that instead of looking at those minutes, I want to give us a further week to look at them, so that when we come next week, we sit down and look at them. But instead, there's a group that we thought needed to come to you at this time, and we requested them in a very short space of time. I think they were told yesterday that they should be here. That's a group called Impumelelo Social Union. I want to pronounce it correctly. What they're doing, they're awarding good work that is done in South Africa. Those who are innovative, who are doing something for South Africans to better their lives, and they go around looking for those innovative things that are done. They're an NGO, so they've done a lot of work. And I'm told that a lot of people in South Africa with their innovations have been winning, not only in South Africa, even internationally. So I feel that I made a decision that if we don't have, we've got a space, why don't we call them so that they just give us, in an hour, just give us what they've done. We might not even ask them a lot of questions, because we're still going to have time with them, so that they could tell us. So they are here today. I'm hoping that they're not going to shout at me that, why did you call them? I don't know them, but I think they are working with us. We need to know about it as members of parliament. So they are here, that's going to give us that synopsis of their work. We're going to start with them. After that, I remember when we were handling the amendment bill on mental health, our questions were actually more not on the bill that was in front of us, but they were more on the mental health services in South Africa. I remember that Hanare in the debate saying in the amendment, he was saying not even a single person or debating was talking about what is in front of us. Everybody was talking about something outside this amendment. He was the only one who was talking on the bill. I'm not sure whether he was right, but that was his comment. Maybe he was right. Then he decided that Hanare, that we should call the department to come and talk about mental health services in South Africa. And some of the reasons, I think one of the most important reasons why we call them is that as South Africans, most of us are angry. Why we are angry? I don't think anybody has made a diagnosis. But that anger in psychotherapy need psychological treatment. And most of the people that I can see, I cannot go to a person age. Probably some of them are there because of psychological problems. And as somebody has said before, that with the way we diagnose mental illnesses, we really diagnose ourselves to feel I'm depressed, I need to get treatment. But that one is very rare. But the commonest one is that difficulty is met, always point fingers at the other that, look, you're not normal. The way you behave is not normal, so you should be mad. That's another way of diagnosing. The third one of diagnosing people who have mental disease is when they cause a serious offense, criminal offense. It's only after they've done that that you notice that somebody was not well. It always comes after that. And most of those people, you only diagnose them when they are in jail. So we think that mental health care services are very important. On the other side, we've got shortage of psychiatrists in South Africa and psychologists. So these are the things that we need to hear from the department. So later on, we'll be entertaining the department on those, and members will be asking those questions. So it was a way of welcoming you, members, and saying that we could go on and start with Impumelelo. And I've asked for your permission, but allow me to accept them, even if it was a unilateral decision, but accept them that they're here. Let's hear what they're doing. And we'll only give you about 30 minutes, and then there'll be questions of clarity. And after that, we're going to have another day with you. But we just want you to summon them. So they're here, members. But before we come to you, members, if you could introduce yourself, so that they can know who they are talking to. This is the Portfolio Committee for Health. The Portfolio Committee is like the essence of Parliament. You should know the work of Parliament. But what types of Parliament is this committee? This one is the Portfolio Committee for Health. So everybody is going to be telling who they are. They are coming from the Portfolio Committee for Health. Obviously, with the people who are helping us to do our job, when the Secretariat, they are all here, the researchers are all here, but it seems as if you are an enemy to them, because everybody sitting on the other side has the only one that sits on that. So maybe, Honorable Dube, we'll start with you. Oh, you're still having your own lunch. We'll start with you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mulebohe Nkaizube, member of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Morning. My name is Patrikanare. I'm a member of the committee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Denise Robinson, also a member of the Health Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Patricia Kopan. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Morosi Sakhalid. This one, a member of the committee.
Morning. My name is Rebecca Motete, member of this committee.
My name is Jasmine Steele, or Kenny Douglas Coates. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Hilda Susagele Msweli, the member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning. I am Hilda. Thank
you. So we'll give over to you, and then we'll go on.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Rhoda Kadali, and I am the Executive Director of Impumelelo, and I brought some of my team along, and that's Tonya Weingart, that is Candace Janssen, this is Chris Wingo, and Simone Crocombe, and one of our award-winning projects who will demonstrate our project to you today. So I'm going to start, since we don't have much time. I briefly want to tell you what Impumelelo does, and then show you some of the best practices that have won awards in the country that I hope that you as politicians will replicate in your constituencies. So we were started in 1999. We're part of an international network of innovators in government, and we have sister programs in the US, Brazil, Mexico, China, Chile, Peru, Kenya and the Philippines. We're all funded by the Ford Foundation, and we all operate independently in our respective countries. So we currently funded by the Ford Foundation, the Open Society Foundation. We were funded by Swedish government, by the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Canadian CEDA, Konrad Adenauer, Claude Leon Foundation, and Liberty Life at the moment. So our mission is to identify, reward, and promote good governance through innovative service delivery. We are now 13 years old, and we have enough material to conduct case study research, and I gave you one copy on HIV as an example of our case study research. We do policy analysis, and then we get the award winners to train public officials in different regions in the country. The ultimate goal is to replicate. If something works in Khayelitsha or in Itakwini, we hold workshops so we can replicate them to other regions. So our goals are to improve the quality of life for the poor, to identify innovation, to encourage good governance. We reward those who break through the red tape. We look at credible portraits of the many ways in which people find solutions to our problems. So those are just a few of the aims that we have, and we do peer-to-peer training. Our criteria are, if you know of a good project and it's innovative, finds a new solution to the old problem, you have to bring to us to evaluate. Look at poverty impact. Does it make a difference in the lives of people? How effectively is the project managed? How effectively are we managed financially? Can the project be replicated and is it sustainable? So initially we were an awards program. So we call for submissions, we screen them, we evaluate them, and then we have a gala award ceremony. Our first award ceremony was in Parliament, where Effa Pard was the keynote speaker. The second was where Ronnie Castle was the keynote speaker. Khada Asma was the keynote speaker. Noma Indian Fakendo was the keynote speaker. So we've had a whole range of politicians to be at our gala ceremony. And so now we do case study research, master classes, and we have a media campaign. And so after 13 years, we have 1,000 funded projects in our database, and we can divide them up into sectors and get government to look at sectors, and that's why we're here today, to present some of the health projects that we've awarded, just so you can know what is going on in the country and that you could possibly ask us to conduct master classes in your constituency. So that's what we are. So initially we were an awards program. As you can see, the awards is the fulcrum around which all of our other activities revolve. Evaluations, policy analysis, and research. Move on. So we give 5 awards. We give a social entrepreneur award, we give a 4 platinum awards, 4 gold, 10 silver, and a star certificate. There is a 2010 gala ceremony in the Artscape Theatre, where we had over 1,500 people. They come because it's the good news of South Africa. People love the award ceremony. Move on. And these are the companies that provide us sponsorship for the awards. We raise about 800,000 to 1 million every year to give to the top projects. The award winners are not allowed to use their money for themselves. They have to use the money to share their success story with others and to replicate the success story. Every year, we submit our top 6 projects to the United Nations for an award. And every year, South Africa wins. You can see since 2003, on the left, you can see the Itakwini Municipality won for a sewage and sanitation project. In Limpopo, a policing project won. Itakwini won water and sanitation, water treatment work, a landfill in Marion Hill, the Palofefa healthcare train, a TB support program, mothers to mothers HIV program, a housing program, a girl child program, and another sanitation program. I brought you one of Lynn Wilkerson. Is one of the people who was shortlisted this year, won 5 projects by the UN. So South Africa had 5 shortlisted, which show that in South Africa, we've got a homegrown solution to our own problems. And I brought a link to demonstrate one of them. So every year we publish an annual magazine, and thus far we've done about 160 case studies. 1 year we dedicated to the women. It's the women who run the country. And so we are amazed every year at the number of women who do amazing things in the country. Those are our case studies. We just show people. In every sector we produce case studies. Move on, Chris. And so after 13 years, we can generate information in those categories. Water, the environment, HIV, housing, sanitation, public works, justice and security, rural development, skills training, arts and culture, food security. All the things that you as politicians are interested in. So today, we use the award winners to train public officials in the Eastern Cape, in Kimberley, in Mpumalanga, Chris, and this is what our masterclasses look like. So we target policymakers, public officials, elected officials, civil society, and community-based organizations. These are an example of our masterclasses where we put the 7 award winners in front of an audience and they present their project. Those people are all from the Itqwini municipality except 2 from Cape Town, who have won international awards and the Mpumalela awards. So what they do, we take them around the country to present their award-winning project to, and that is the Eastern Cape Joe Garvey District Municipality. They asked us, and Tavi Singh, who is the head of Joe Geda, the woman in the middle, asked us to conduct a masterclass there on sanitation and waste management and recycling. That one was done in Buffalo City. There we have the Deputy Mayor of Buffalo City, Mr. Mfoki, who invited us to present to his municipality with the industrial development zone in the Eastern Cape. And that's just a typical example of our masterclasses where we put the award winners to the official and they ask, how did you get it right? We had a skills development training workshop, Criticus. We had a 2010 sustainability workshop. We had a rural development workshop where the President Zuma's right-hand man came to study all of those projects to help him write the position paper. We had an environment workshop with the Development Bank of South Africa in Joburg. In 2008, we did a skills training workshop where all the award winners presented their projects. We had 2 HIV/AIDS cutting-edge HIV/AIDS projects, workshops. In 2005, we did a public works workshop where the 9 provincial coordinators met for the first time. So we create a platform for public officials to get together. So we can now track all the award winners in the Western Cape, for example, in arts and culture, social development, HIV/AIDS, education, and so on. So we track it for every province. Those are projects in the Eastern Cape. That's KwaZulu-Natal. That's Limpopo. That is, Free State, Mpumalanga, Northwest, and Gauteng, Northern Cape. So we'll just come back, Chris. So now we're going to start and just to demonstrate some of the award-winning projects that won an Mpumalanga Award and that were shortlisted for a UN Award. Is that okay? So we're going to talk to you about Global Care Group in Limpopo. Now, if you look at their motto at the bottom, they say HIV is not a death sentence, a disease, but it's a catalyst for development. The Global Care Group was started in Limpopo by a doctor who took out a bond on his house. He built this clinic, and then he trained the local people to run that clinic. Here you can see he employed 320 local people to run the office. Soon they added a maternity ward. And here you can see the local people running the pharmacy. And he said his human resource strategy is to train local people to run the clinic, and they have cutting-edge computer equipment so they can track HIV/AIDS defaulters. So if you're HIV positive, you get your results within 24 hours. They connected to a rural doctor program that provides incentives for rural doctors not to leave the area, and so to attract them is to have cutting edge technology. They have quite an extensive outreach program and a comprehensive HIV/AIDS awareness program with billboards everywhere, even on the main route going to Limpopo. Here is Zikali. Now, emanating from this HIV/AIDS project are a whole lot of small entrepreneurs. Zikali decided, and Global has got an outreach program. They have a lot of cars. I'm going to provide petrol for the cars of the clinic and Medicine Sans Frontières and the UN. So Zikali has his one-stop petrol station. They started a community internet cafe for young people with computer centers. They started a nappy factory. The women in that community, they make their own nappies. These eight guys have started a construction company and they build all the facilities that the clinic needs. One young guy started a car wash business and he's making quite a lot of money. And then they discovered that they needed water and they dug their own water boreholes. And after a couple of years, they now have 44 water boreholes. What does that mean? They manage their own water boreholes amongst themselves as citizens to share the water equitably and to be accountable about water usage. They also now have a waste removal project. They have provided all kinds of entertainment for young people. They put up the screen of the 2010 soccer cup. They now have that construction company built the amphitheater for 1,500 people, and they got a conductor from the Dartmouth Boys Choir to train their local youth, and they have since sung in the Royal Albert Hall in England. They also have a nutrition program. They don't only deal with undernutrition, but also overnutrition. So they have a gym to train the local people how to effectively deal with food security issues. They provide these courts for young people to play sports, netball, tennis. And here you can see they have a community and a food garden based on the door concept. So on the side of the door, you can plant enough nutritional vegetables for you and your family. So Richard Branson came to hear about this project and he wrote a book about it and he included Dr. Templeman's life in the book, and then Richard Branson replicated the same project to Nelspruit in Mpumalanga. There you have it. Do you want to talk about it, Chris?
So they're starting and looking at the same ideas is building that foundation of creating a health infrastructure and keeping and retaining those rural health skills, giving young people skills, getting people healthy. So in Limpopo right now, they're actually replicating it in a number of different areas, but this clinic in Limpopo is one of their replication efforts that is the most successful right now, and they've really done a lot to decrease the HIV, to get more people on ARVs as well. We'd like to end the slideshow because Global is really an example of how addressing health is actually a great catalyst for development and looking at the systemic nature of poverty alleviation. And innovation is very important to what they do in that regard. They don't have wheelchairs, so they help make wheelchairs with garden hoses with this construction company. And the last thing that they've also started doing is looking at their own medical waste incineration. Because this is a huge problem in rural areas where there's very little regulation on the private companies who are doing this medical waste incineration. So it's helping to build people's skills at the clinic to actually do this themselves. And the model is built on a pottery kiln concept. So it burns to 120 degrees Celsius. There's no carcinogen waste carcinogen smoke that comes off the waste is incinerated. And a real example of how one rural clinic in Yelan Doring has a waterfall clinic all over South Africa to incinerate their own medical waste as a form of economic development as well as health alleviation. And Yelan Doring is not possible, the development of Yelan Doring is not possible without Ndlovu. Because of that project, they actually are on the map. They have a postal code. The clinic is the hub around which all economic and social activity runs in Yelan Doring. And because of Ndlovu, they have a postal code as well as all sorts of social development projects that exist around it. And they are a great example of inspiring creative public-private partnerships with the intervention that they do, with bringing on board all of these corporate as well as NGO networks in the Limpopo area.
Okay. Now we're going to ask Lynn, one of our award winners and the shortlisted candidate for the ARV club model, to demonstrate this amazing, this is a simple but an amazing intervention for alleviating the queues. I want you here.
While we wait for the presentation, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lynn Wilkinson. I run Medicine Sans Frontières with Doctors Without Borders in Khayelitsha. We've been present in Khayelitsha for the last 10 years working on HIV and TB, and now drug-resistant TB. And I've come to present to you a model of care that we piloted in Khayelitsha and which has now spread at least in the Western Cape and to other parts of South Africa. Okay, so I know many of us sitting in the room know the problem, but it's always important just to put it into perspective. So in South Africa, we estimate that we have approximately 5.5 million South Africans that are HIV positive. That's the biggest absolute numbers of HIV-positive people in any country in the world. Today, we have just over 1.9 million people on ARV, on antiretroviral treatment for HIV. This is also the biggest number of patients in any country in the world on ARVs. But South Africa has committed that by 2015, we'll have 3 million people on treatment. That's another million that we need to put on treatment. But we also need to keep the people that we've already put on treatment in care. And sometimes we forget about this last time. We're all very focused on making sure that people can access care and that we can put them onto care. But if we lose improper care, most of the work that we've done is wasted. And so South Africa has committed that we're going to try to ensure that we have 70% of our patients who start ARVs still on ARVs at the end of 5 years. Today we're quite far from that goal. Most of our systematic reviews are showing much lower outcomes. And so many of us have been trying to think how we can improve the retention in care, how we can improve keeping people in care once we've started them on treatment. And this model of care is really aimed at that. Okay. So obviously, as our numbers are growing, the more our facilities are struggling, because eventually our facility needs to be able to keep coping with these new people that need to be started on treatment, as well as the people that are already in care. And as the clinics get busier and busier, they have less time and less space for our patients that are not doing well, for our patients that are failing treatment or are clinically unstable. Next. At the same time, our patients that are on treatment and are doing incredibly well, they're stable, they're healthy, they're back at work, are getting extremely frustrated by having to come to the clinic every month or every 2 months to sit in the clinic the whole day to receive their treatment. It becomes increasingly difficult when you have to take time off work without explaining why you're not coming to work to your employer. And so many of our patients get into this situation after 2 or 3 years where they're stable on treatment, where they start making difficult decisions, where they need to work to support their families, and they can't get time off work, or where their family demands perhaps to look after a family member become increasingly important. And so patients then decide, I can't keep coming to the clinic every 2 months, sitting there the whole day, and so they stop taking their treatment and they stop coming to our care. And so we're really trying to work out how we can make it easier, how we can make it simpler for people that are doing well on treatment to be able to access their treatment without taking a lot of time out of their day. So this explains it to you. So really, have you been taking is suppressed in your body, so essentially we know you're doing well, and are you really tired of waiting in long queues? Then the club model, which we've designed, is really your solution. And what this is we, as a quick service option, when 30 stable clinically stable patients are grouped together, they meet sometimes in the clinic, but sometimes at community venues outside of the clinic, and that's what we're pushing for. The groups meet outside of the clinic, they meet for 45 minutes in the morning, and they're given their treatment, which is already in pre-packed. They're given by a lay person who runs a small support group, which just links in with everyone, makes sure that everyone knows what's happening, and a little bit of sharing between the group. And if anybody complains of being ill, we're able to refer them to the clinic. And once a year, those patients are seen at their clinic for their annual clinical visit. So really what we're saying is that patients don't need to go to their clinic every month or every 2 months when they're stable. What they need to do is be able to access their treatment easily so that they stay on treatment. But we have to be governing them clinically. We have to make sure that those sick patients, someone who's coughing or someone who's losing weight, is managed and referred directly into the clinic service. And then once a year, we spend that good, 30 minutes with a patient, review their blood results, make sure that they're clinically well. So that's really the model. Next slide. So very briefly, I'll explain that every 2 months they come to the club, and once a year they go to their clinic. As counselor-led, that means we're really reducing the workload on our clinicians. So patients are not seen by our nurses and our doctors every month or every 2 months. They're seen by a lay worker who we train to run the club, and that really reduces the load on our clinicians. The benefits are quite obvious. I think we've gone through them from the beginning. For the patient, it means easier access. It means they develop a group dynamic with their peers, which really helps for when a patient goes missing, that their colleagues will say, oh, I know where that lady is. She's gone to the Eastern Cape for a funeral. She'll be back next month. It also makes sure that we can monitor what's happening in those groups. And it relieves the pressure on our health system, which I think is one of the main key points here. It means that those patients are not taking up the time in the clinics. That means that there's space in the clinics for our new patients and for our patients that are not doing well, that are clinically unstable and who need our doctors and nurses' time. The model, MSF always provides evidence for our models, and so essentially we compared the patients that were in the club versus patients that qualified for club but didn't get into the club over 4 years, 40 months, and we showed that the retention of patients that were in club was 97% compared to our patients that weren't in club, which only then had a retention care about 85%. So we can see that by making it easier for people to get their treatment, they actually do much better and they stay in care. And the second point, 67% less virological rebound, that really means that the patient adheres better to the treatment. They took their tablets more regularly than our patients that weren't in club. The model then was looked at by the Western Cape Departments of Health, and we worked closely with the Western Cape Departments of Health in Khayelitsha. They really liked the model, and so we formed a steering committee at provincial level made up of the Department of Health, City Health, MSF, myself, and another partner, IHI, that works on spreading models of care. And with this team, over a very short space of time, you can see there, January 2011, March 2013, so just over 2 years, we were able to set up 670 clubs in the Cape Metro. We have almost 18,000 patients enrolled in club care. That means these patients are getting their treatment in these groups of 50 people, sometimes meeting the facility, sometimes meeting in community venues. And really that means that just in the Cape Metro, we've taken 16% of our ARV cohort out of our clinics in community management, which means we're freeing up that space to allow new patients and those that are struggling. And so we at MSF and as the Department of Health with Mpumelelo support are very excited about how quickly this model is possible to roll up. We're advocating strongly for it to be adopted as South African a national policy and that we can roll out these clubs in many areas that are struggling both with the heavy burden on the health system but also where their patients are struggling to stay in care. Then we won the Mpumelelo Award this year, which we're very excited about. And it's also nice for the team spirit between the collaboration. collaboration between MSF and the Department of Health, and we won the award money. And so what we decided to do with that award money is to run a video conference with four or five sites, one in Gauteng, one in Durban, one in East London, one in George, and one in Cape Town, where we were able to teach on the model. So we invited our colleagues in the HASS department in the provincial department and certain districts, as well as NPOs that are working in the different provinces, to attend that video conference so we could teach on the model and suggest that perhaps other provinces and other districts look at rolling out the model. Thank you for your time.
Would you like to ask questions on those two projects before we go any further? Dr. Kwan, should we do just two more quickly? Or do you think we should have questions?
No, in fact, I want to make a suggestion.
Okay.
Yeah, because of time.
Yep.
And the fact that we're going to meet again.
Yeah.
The aim was to allow members to see what they're doing. And then we can come with the details of projects that we've actually said later on. Members, that is the presentation. I think the presentation basically. It's about the fact that South Africa is unique. It has got its own challenges. And there is a term that says nothing about us without us. So they are looking at the innovations in South Africa done by South Africans for their own improvement, their own development. And which means that we've got to make our own people to be innovative and come up with ideas, and that actually helps our government to go forward and make sure that we develop South Africa. That is the best thing, and the projects that have been shown here are actually done by South Africans in South Africa, and with the help of those who've got money because they're an NGO. And that can be rolled out into government and say, I mean, look at the last project. It says if those people continue doing that, they will reduce the load in hospitals. And they can go in and out. The other one, you just sit down and make a rural development in a particular place, and you saw how the clinic that was started has actually made other businesses in the same area. That improves our poverty. That is the key that we wanted you to see. But we're hoping that they are going to have time later on to come back and make a proper presentation of all the projects that they've actually seen. That they've actually promoted and will come to the other thing. But I'm sure you might have a few questions to ask them before we allow them to go, and then we can go on to the next. Thank you very much for your presentation, and especially that they are actually done by South Africans in South Africa. Remember that it's up to you if you want to ask a few questions. By the way, they were given only one day to come and do this.
Thank you very much, President, for the presentation. And I think these are the things which happen in South Africa and are not known. And I'm happy that today we know. But they may, because the person is saying that you are going to come again, you need not answer those questions. Maybe it will be on the preparation of your presentation so that you cover what I'm going to ask. You have come to Parliament, and I've seen that you are involved in the nine provinces. I want to know your relationship with the provincial legislatures in those provinces, because we are at national. But we do have people at provincial level and at district level. And another thing, you are saying, I could presume that this is Umelelo at national. And I would like to know, I have heard the presentation of the Western Cape, which says that they are working with the Department of Health. I want to know you, how do you work with the National Department of Health. I'm having a little bit, maybe it's just when things are new, you become a little bit skeptical. There is this abuse of ARV. Now you are advocating that we should take the medication to the people, lay people, all those things. How do you really see to it if they are not abused? Because we know that this drug, which is being done, is ARV, all those things. Certain people sell ARV for whatever. I think I will want to hear much about administrative support of TB, not today, because TB is a problem. How do you help us, and what have you achieved? For now, I will say thanks 10%, but there is lots, and I think that we are going to get those presentations so that we can look at them, so that really when you come back, because really I came here for mental health bill. Now when you come in, I didn't prepare for you, so that we prepare, we move on the same page. And
so really you've got one brain and you prepared for something.
No, another thing which I wanted to know, where do they get their data from? When they say, among others, that HIV positive 5.5 million. And I know that the data collection is a problem. How accurate do you think? And I know it cannot be accurate because I'm sitting here, you don't know me, I'm HIV, but I didn't go anyway. Thank you.
Thank you, Miss. I enjoyed the presentation with the short news that you can come into this room and it will tell you how much TB can you get in this room. It's an innovation, but they will bring it when they come back. This is a short news.
Around it or each other.
last question I think is important. So, Simpiwe Dwenga from the Eastern Cape Development Zone, he comes to us and he says, I'd like you to do a workshop or masterclass training with the Eastern Cape Municipal Offices. We then present that to CEDA, the Canadian Government International Development Agency, and we say to them, we'd like to go to the Eastern Cape, to Buffalo City. We want to take 7 of our presenters. We give them a cost of the whole thing. And CEDA has been supporting that kind of training for the last 2 years. So they pay for everything. We can fly our 7 presenters, the catering, the venue hire. Normally, government gives us a building, and we often don't have to pay for venue hire. And catering is done locally. So we have been able, either the Konrad Adenauer Foundation or CEDA pays for our masterclass training. We just busy with another proposal for 3 masterclass training for next year. And we're focusing on the Eastern Cape in particular to strengthen the Eastern Cape. We want to build a critical mass. I mean, we had one in Elbow North, and there were 70 people, mostly from local authorities, municipal structures, and with the Joe Gardy municipality that we worked with, district, sorry. So if people come and ask us, then we lay it on. Because these are award winners, we take them around the country, and we now, they're part of our network. We've just launched a network, so we are a resource for government, to strengthen government. So when the municipal mayor of Buffalo City asked us, we went. When Sapira asked us, we went. When Ntabi Singh asked us, we went. And CEDA pays for it. So we're 12 years old. We're mainly funded by the Open Society and Ford Foundation. They have been our seed funders right from the start. And we've been able to get bits of money here and there. That we have survived is quite amazing, because we were founded by Idasa, that died an unholy death last year, and we survived them. Because they founded us in a way. They founded the idea, and I set up the office. I established it. And can she just answer the question of the statistics? 5 and 5?
I think we would usually like them to complete their question, so that when you answer everything, especially that we don't have the luxury of time. So we would like to organize that. I'm not sure where members you. You completed your question. Are there some people that wanted to ask questions? Well, it seems as if those are the only questions and you can go on to
answer. Hang on to your, I think with 2 questions really. The first was on the statistics. The statistics are our national statistics, confirmed both by Departments of Health nationally as well as by WHO and the partners that are working in South Africa. And they're mostly based on MRC specifics where people were tested randomly to be able to try and get prevalent data in different provinces, which obviously ranges. I think they're relatively reliable. I think most of us believe they are. Also, our numbers of patients on ARVs is also relatively reliable, although we're all working at the moment on trying to improve our data systems all the time. On your concern about pharmaceutical control, essentially for every drug control, the clubs, it's important to understand that we're not just giving a whole bag of ARVs to a person and saying, go and hand them out to the group. Essentially, the medicines are pre-packed, per script, labeled for the patients, taken by the leg worker to hand out to the patients, and if the patient is not there, immediately returned to the clinic pharmacy. So there's extremely strict control over the pharmaceutical. We have no concerns at the moment that in any way is it possible for the drug to go missing or to be bought or to be traded through the system. There is a concern in South Africa about ARVs being used for various recreational purposes. From our experience in Khayelitsha, this is overstated. It's very uncommon, although it does happen from time to time. And I think our strongest defense against it is to make sure that the fixed dose combination, which has been endorsed, is rolled out to all of our patients as quickly as possible. Because the drug that's a concern is efavirenz, which is one of the ARVs. And as soon as it's combined, it's a fixed dose combination pill, it becomes less of a risk. So I think the sooner we get those rolled out in all of our clinics and available to all of our patients, the risk is vastly reduced.
On your TV question,
There is a project called the Administration of TB Support. They also won the United Nations Award, and they are now responsible for getting Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi to deal with TB in the prison. So they are just a fantastic project that uses lay people to administer the TB treatment to people. I think what I want to end with this, we will be amazed to know how professional lay people have become in the community of home-based care, with voluntary testing and counseling, mothers to mothers, where people in their indigenous languages can obtain others and take work away from the doctors and take over the burdens where doctors are not as burdened with all work. And that's what we've seen, and Patricia is one of those products of people who has become absolute experts on HIV and AIDS. And that's how you empower people to take control of their. So when we come, we'll entertain you with the most amazing people who do wonderful things in the country. And I hope that we can work with the elected officials to take those to their constituencies. So if you invite us to your constituency, we will come and do training there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The problem is that we will find time to call you and give us all the projects that you're going to do. But what is important, members here, is that these are innovations by South Africans, for South Africa, for our asymmetrical country. It's not only about health, but they mentioned most of those, but it's about everything, and our problem is poverty and unemployment. And it seems as if we create our own innovations. But by the way, even the Nyaupe, it's an innovation. But it's an opposite innovation. We don't want those innovations. We want innovations that are going to help people, not to affect our security. So thank you very much. We'll give you a date when to come back and talk to us on all your projects, including that one that can pick up TB. We could know where TB is the most prevalent area of TB. Thank you very much.
Chair, and thank you, committee. Mm-hmm. Keep well.
While they're moving out, maybe we can have a 5-minute break, and while health is preparing to do their presentation.
Thank you. 8 minutes. Hmm. Okay.
To run away from those things that seem to
voluntary and involuntary committing people. I can go myself and other people can bring me there. And then he also clarified that by saying, if you are taken, if it is involuntary, there's an observation of 72 hours. It answered my question, because when he was talking about involuntary, I wanted to talk about husbands who take wives to mental care, claiming that they are sick and blah, blah, blah. But now at the end of the talk, he's talking about, when we talk about straight people who are mentally ill, that they can easily be cured in community or be helped within communities, whereby their rights must not be trampled by us involuntarily, because committing them there is like taking them to a ministry. Now, this last point is confusing me. Where do we draw the line of, when do we take a person in as an involuntary person, and when do we say this one can be treated? Because I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a nurse, I'm not blah blah blah, I'm not a doctor. But I see here is a person in the street looking, you know, mentally ill and maybe being like looking violent. How do I say this one, we can say we are going to treat this one in the community, or this one needs to be committed? That's the only point that I need that to set.
Maybe to add to what Chris said, Dr. Clinton, in Eastern Cape, in Transkei, there was one time when somebody was mentally ill, started to rape somebody in the street. You could see that person didn't have an insight in front of the people. And then they decided to take all those that had no insight themselves to hospital with the police because they were refusing to help the police. But the somebody from Greater who came up and said they were impinging on their human rights by taking them to hospital. I think this is a question that is being asked. If you take somebody who doesn't have insight to themselves, doing something wrong, and then you take them to the hospital, use the police, somebody says they're impinging on their human rights. But what am I from doing?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank for the presentation. You can see that the presenter has passion. He was doing it with passion, and I was asking myself, how could he have done if this was a workshop? Because I think we really need a workshop. However, I do have some question on the presentation. But, Doctor, I think since 2009, when we got here, we have been talking about number and the pages. It is very, very easy for a person to recognize. Now, some are numbers, some are not, but I can see the 1 meter numbers are cut and paste. Okay. You said that around 3/4 of the people in South Africa that suffer from mental disorder do not currently receive mental intervention. I would like you to elaborate, and I would like to really know what the department plan. I think when you go on, you try to talk about it. I don't know if I'm right when you talk about community participation. That order which is the people are not receiving mentally, or really what did you mean? Then you talk about association between poverty and mental health, and you explain. But where I'm sitting, I think when a person, there is poverty and there is low nutrition, or the nutrition is poor, and the person become pregnant, it will affect the development of certain parts, including the brain. And from my observation, mostly when you look at but I would like to know the nutrition, the poor nutrition and mental illness. Mental health coordinator and sub-district level, it has been a problem teaching. And you find that other sub-districts, do you know, when I say sub-district, I'll be saying sub-district because where I was working, we were serving the district, sub-district, and I don't, in Northwest. And what I know, it is different to other places. But you find that some sub-districts do have coordinator for mental health, coordinator, others they don't. And the issue of OSD has really caused, because you find that if a nurse is in the clinic, the OSD favors that particular person, like a person in the sub-district who's coordinating mental health. I would like to know now, how have you dealt with that problem? Because there was disparity and people tend to move from being coordinators to clinic, to get the clinic because of the OSD. Then you talk about designated selected health centers and clinics to provide psychological service. Then it baffles me when it's designated. Because to me, when I would like to see mental health or psychiatry as a basic course, whereby each and every nurse who's going to be in the primary healthcare setting must have that comprehensive course to really give a comprehensive health care. Then the last one. How can we strengthen structures at local level to have all relevant departments and civic society to form forums that address mental health illness in the community? Because to me, we are still heading that way. You find the staff, the correctional studies, all those things. How can we really strengthen that? And you are, when you talk, I can see that you are really looking forward to improve the mental health in the department. But I think maybe in one document we'll have the when, because really this has been a chronic, long-standing problem. Like you are talking about the gaping of spider. When you look at Bobby Long Hospital in Manike, when they build the modern Mafikeng Hospital next to Bukelo, they left the dilapidated part for the psychiatry hospital. When you go to hospitals, you find that mostly they are dilapidated. And even in our rehabilitation, maybe I'm talking to where I come from. I haven't seen the hospitals in the revitalization. Program been taken very seriously. And the last, I'm not afraid to say, but what I have seen, except you, doctor, most of the people who work in the psychiatry, in the psychiatry, the nurses and the doctors, when you look at them at a certain period, you find that it seems as if. Now, you said that it's not communicable, but now I was asking, I tried to count, I even count the other doctor who was here not long. Then I said, I know that this, I knew this doctor before, he becomes specialist in psychiatry, but when I look at him now, it seems that I would like to know what does that really mean, or do we tend to imitate the patients? Because most of the nurses and the doctors, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure if you saw a film. Okay, I'm going to come back. There's a film of the psychiatrist who was treating a patient. I don't know if you saw a film. This guy was treating this patient, and then the patient kept on calling him panic again, and it ended up being the patient who was trying to treat the psychiatrist.
The only people who are hardly ever affected are pharmacists who provide that type of medication. They just dispense them, they don't take them. So most tend to take some of this medicine.
What did you try to protect yourself? We try to protect your prophecy. Okay, it comes back.
Thank you, Shepherd. But I would like to give you, I've been trying to work in the psychiatric hospital. One thing that I've noticed about my psychiatric patient, you will never give them the wrong medication. So they know exactly the strength and the color. So it was nice working there. I enjoyed working there. No, not at all. Thank you for the presentation. My question is relating to the prevalence of mental disorder. You said 16.5% of South African adults they are having this mental disorder, but I wanted to, if maybe it could have been better if you give us the breakdown in terms of different provinces so that we have an idea where this 16.5% comes from. The second one is about the prevalence of child and adolescent mental disorder in the Western Cape. You said it's 17%. Okay, but there's no national data. Why there's no national data? Because we also wanted to know what happened in other provinces. The other thing is regarding to... One thing that struck me that was very interesting, you talk about our history, where we come from, how many people they give up their lives to, you know, to fight for liberation, and they never went to school. It is very sad that they liberated us. So I wanted to find out, is there any study that was done in terms of the impact of this? How far, military has that? My other question is related to the health facilities. You gave us a nice picture about different provinces. But when I was looking around to check all the provinces, what struck me, it was about five provinces. They don't have a child adolescent outpatient clinics. And I was asking myself, how do they cope with the child and adolescent mental disorder in that area if they don't have clinics? Because Mpumalanga is zero. In both is zero. Eastern Cape, I'm not sure. And Northern Cape is zero. Northwest is also zero. My other question is about what proportion of the health budget is devoted for the mental health? Because every time when one is doing oversight going to different psychiatric hospitals, they are telling that there is no budget for this. So the last time it was on the 23rd of January this year, I went to the psychiatric hospital in Bloemfontein. When I trained there, I went there, but it was one of the beautiful places. But on my arrival, the loan was as tall as my size. So the facility from outside, it was not like a hospital. The windows were open, you know, the underwear were just, it was like that bit of the hospital during apartheid. It was not like a hospital. Inside, the ceilings were falling apart. The patients, they were not even covered there. You know, the clothes were lying on the floor. It was not a picture of the hospital. And the other thing that I realized then, there was no activity. Rehabilitation is no longer happening in the mental hospital. So I wanted to find out what the department is doing to make sure that the budget that is there is really trying to cover up all the challenges that I talk about. The reason why I was in that hospital, say to all of our psychiatric patients in hospital, it was zero. The very same hospital, there was a patient who was raped by one of the security guards. And what came to me is that the security companies that are employed by the hospital are not professional people. Secondly, a vetting is not done. So I wanted to find out what is it that the department is going to do to make sure that this problem really is going to be solved. One of my questions or my comment is, I could see here according to the draft master plan, the department is trying to work with social development, trying to get people into community rehabilitation centers. But my question is, I would like to see the department working closely with the department to make sure that the rehabilitation centers that are established, they are registered, because they also give medication there. I happen to be in that one, the one that's always on the media, only a week or middle leg. When I arrived there, the medications were not even locked. Some of the medications were even expired. There was only nurse was there, but the people who are working, who are going to be the health personnel people who are working in the meditation center, they claim to be professional people, but they are not professional people. So I would like to make sure that the department maybe can be engaged more in those rehabilitation centers. One of the things that I noticed about the presentation here is the challenge in terms of the staff to see that only 40% of our clinical experience can obtain well service to the population of 85% of our people. It is really sad. But what I want to know from the department, I want to know presently, as we are speaking right now, how many psychiatric nurses are training people who want to be psychiatric nurses? Because the very same psychiatric hospital where I was, it was only a nursing assistant, and the other, it was there was no professional nurse. There were those people, they don't have any psychiatric nursing, you know, knowledge or anything, but we were making the psychiatric institution. So it shows that we don't have psychiatric, don't have on paper, we might have psychiatric nurses who are there, but where are they? Are they working within the very same department where they're supposed to be working? How many of them are still training? Even the psychiatric doctors, how many of them are still on training? That's what I would like to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this presentation. It was thorough, it was in-depth, and it was really answering all the questions that I had asked. And I have a particular interest in this field. I think you discovered that. And if there is any need to involve us or to get us involved in some of your committees, I'd be very happy to do so. I feel this is an area that is sadly, unfortunately, the Cinderella aspect of our medical health. So one of the problems you have, and which we share, and I've mentioned this in my budget speech, is the lack of funding. How do we achieve all the things that we want to do? We've got to look at that cake and see how it can be sliced up. But I think we need more of an emphasis in that. And if you can lobby for that, we will certainly lobby from our side as well. But I think we have to also be creative in our approach and see how we can build up partnerships where there are private facilities or benefactors who might be able to assist, because we need the specialized care. Now, this isn't relevant to this particular thing, but I've been to see a specialist at Rosa Skier. He's got wonderful equipment, but he hasn't got the budget for staff. So you don't have that pathologist who has got the necessary ability. And I think this is where we're falling short here, too. I also visited five years and mental health institutions here and spoken to doctors. Now, you come up with a solution, which is it must be more community-based rather than hospital-based. Mm-hmm. I accept that. But why are the people wandering around in the streets? Because the community facility or program aren't there. So how do we actually bring that in? I do know that there are some people who do alternative medicine and do lots of counseling, and they have workshops and peer group support. Works as well. But there's always the problem of funding. And how is this going to happen? I don't know whether there is going to be or can be more assistance from the provinces or from national. But those people who are doing this work on a voluntary basis, I do believe, need to have more support. Peer group support works very well, I think. My colleague mentioned street people. That was also a project that I started when I was still in the city council a year ago. The people are so vulnerable. Alcohol plays a part, alcoholism and drug abuse at the moment as well. But what does one do and how does one deal with it? Now, Cape Town has a very well-developed program. I was part of it way back when, but they've gone much beyond it. But we still have the problem, how do you find a place for those people? Where do they go? You've got the assessment centres, but you don't have anywhere permanent to stay. Now, the municipalities actually don't have the funding to provide permanent accommodation. There's a link between the provincial departments of social development, but I don't know if there is a place there for national to come in as well. Perhaps there should be some greater cooperation, but again, it's a matter of funding. It overlaps with the trauma centres in our police stations. How many of them are closed? They're actually not functioning, and they should have them. The people, the battered women, who often end up in care, people with psychiatric problems as well. They are battered. There's nowhere for them to go. And very often our police people are also suffering from trauma because of all the work they do. So again, these blurred lines, I don't know how we're going to solve it. But safe houses, to Zella type centres, there are not enough of them. And I know it's not your department, but I think we've got to look at it as a whole, because we are people and we don't fall into little silos. The NHI model is great, but is it going to work if we don't have enough funding? And I've been a great proponent of primary health care, mentioned that in my budget speech as well, not enough funding. But I was told yesterday about a case where we say, yes, there should be psychiatric assistance and evaluation and screening at the primary health care. But I was told about Graaf Reinet, where there was a person whose child was really severely disturbed, went to the clinic time after time, but the person who was meant to be providing the service wasn't there. The person had to come from Craddock or from Port Elizabeth. There was no transport. You know, so we've got the ideal, but the practical implication is what we have to look at. So you've got a young person now who's really rampant and raging and is not being looked after. So what will happen? He'll be probably locked up in the end, and it's not the answer. Fetal alcohol syndrome, I think we've spoken about that, and children, and autism, as you know, is also one of my passions. So if we're going to be looking at it again, why is it that schools for people, children with autism, have to be sponsored only by private institutions? It needs to be available far more. So again, a big question mark. I'm not providing any answers here. Nutrition is something that was mentioned. I won't go into that. And then, of course, the link of HIV/AIDS, people suffering from that with the mental disturbances that sometimes do follow the medication. Again, you identified it, but have you got any solutions? Thank you.
Another problem. I saw a hand from Makenya. I'm not sure whether the other hands. Oh, okay, let's start with Makenya, then we'll come from some comments.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the conversation. I think first start by saying some of these provisions I tend not to know them. If you can just on my first question is on BALYS that talks to 16U97203. I think that is on page, as you said, that there's a possible number of this. Of these rights, so we end up sometimes blessing when we answer questions, when we ask questions. I think it's on the globe, total DALY. Secondly, you talked about on the heading that kept to looking at mental health in South Africa, you talked about the new service, mentalized individuals who have now returned to civil in life. And also, we talked about the severe social and other updates. And also, on the problems of mental disorder, we talked about the high percentage of 43% of mental disorder in patients with HIV/AIDS, which to maybe, I assume, maybe it's due to lack of proper pre- and post-counseling, but I'm not quite sure, because most of these patients, when they are diagnosed, often change the behavior. So my question to that, in your plan, and say that there are the plan or recommendations or tasking tasking members appointed to deal with the resolutions, the recommendations. So there are the recommendations. And I said that you talked about I don't know what you have what is your stance in this case. Can't you also have the support centers for counseling so that they are there and the support centers counseling and support centers are being started to develop to make an alarm so that these patients have an ongoing as much as about habitation, but I'm thinking of the engineering of stomach health care and mental health. so that they get ongoing treatment, ongoing counseling, not only to get counseling at that time, but to get an ongoing permanent counseling, so as to revise their sense of behavior. Again, we talked about the wastages. I think Honorable Kofa asked about the what I was going to ask concerning the other provinces, if you say that the percent is what I've already asked. And the issue of drug master plan, and I don't know whether to say on the spot analysis, don't you think also it is necessary to maybe your partnership with development and a diversity of development and development of education? Can we say also there must be schools, even if we say magistrates, to have also the same support for that, because to our understanding, some of these young people are talking about mental disturbance is due to these drugs, to certain drugs. If we account also when we are dealing with the recommendations, also edge on what can we do for these children at school. I know this is a lot of job when you say that there must be a support center at school and something like that. Maybe if you can say there must be a center, even if the center is magistrate. Looking also at this center to be either in a tertiary, one for the tertiary and one for the high education. So that even those kids we are talking about that you say that they lack mother at the age of the youngest ages. So they cannot not to have the major state that is stable. So that they can also be looked at their earlier stages. And lastly, maybe it's not some of my questions been asked. And lastly, you talk about the establishment of a national suicide prevention. How are we going to make? How are we going to make just to allow it or to affect that establishment? Because really this is a very bad because the national suicide is prevalent these days because of this action, because they can't seem afraid. That's why some of them all of these patients end up killing themselves. So I think that lastly. That's my question. I think for now, let's stay because some of the questions have been asked. Yes, I think this one has been asked. And so, thank you very much.
That's okay. I'll get another room, son.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. My questions are, what are the challenges in working with the Department of Social Development in providing social support to the families of patients? The other one is, what is the impact of HIV and AIDS on mental health? And has this been measured? The last one, although it has been asked in other way around. Are there forensic psychiatric units in all these 9 provinces? I think that is all, because these 3/4 of people in South Africa suffer from a mental disorder. It has been asked by my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and let me also thank the presenters. I support my colleague about workshop of the program because my time is what I concerning such a community. pick up on what some of the focus, so it covers most of my issues. But secondly, I'm saying my constituent 3 kilometers to Dr. Mukhari was talking about it. There was a type of facing the main road to the road. Sorry. If you can see the tent there, and inside I don't talk. So when you say, well, there is a psychiatry or something, it's the people who are treated there that are not there. So I just propose that they are not being taken care of this psychiatric hospital with a serious concern to access the environment of the community. And also to check the structural work. I don't know whether they need to check the health office at influence member. Then when we recommended to this sick lady to be taken to the place of safety, they said the place of safety for them is only Niger. I think Niger is included in the former land. Now it was really difficult for us to reduce it because of the conflict. Can we get a something that was part of it? Because I think the amendment was done with the act.
That's my question. I think also the question, I'm not sure Mohammed, but you wanted to ask something before I ask the last question from Mohammed Abdul Sahal.
Thank you, Chairperson. So I'm not well today. Chairperson, maybe it's because we are talking about the mental. I always saw those people who are working in that area, they are also not well. Chairperson, my worry is that if maybe I can get a clarity or maybe it's misunderstanding. I always see these people of mental traveling every day from one province to another. They are using these ambulances. They are tightening them. You see, it's care and a shame because you find that they, in Mpumalanga most of the time and in Popo, they are traveling most in the morning to Gauteng. I just want to ask the department how the problem is that they can travel every day. And then maybe a clarity that I hear that the Pretoria West one is closed. I don't know what's the problem on that one. Thank you, Chairman.
You can't just sit and I am the health problem of committee. Honorable Sahal, if I am you, please ask something.
I'm very sorry, I just forgot this, and it's so important to me. I think Honorable Mosika touched it, but I want to maybe elaborate on it. I want to know your protocol on referral. The issue of transporting a mentally ill patient from one center to the other. You find that at a certain stage, I don't know if it was, it is still a practice whereby you, the police has to be involved, and you find that they too don't want to transport the patient. Now, there is a nurse in the clinic who should transport the patient, who requires the patient, but the transportation is a problem. Can you just tell me what have you done around the patient?
Thank you,
Melaka. Thank you, Chairperson. Lastly, I think also that is distracting. That's why now we just want to make yes, our assurance that this so if what this is going to help us. There's also this issue that we say that the lack of iodine on neonates have a negative effect on mental development of a child. How does the mental health research take this into account? Thank you, Chairperson.
There's one thing that I used to happen. You know, the time we were doing psychiatry,
respond broadly to the funding and some of the approaches that you're going for. The main is the budget structure, and I think honorable members may be aware. We have allocations at a national level, and our interaction with provinces in terms of allocation is through grants only. But the rest of the allocations come directly from national treasury to provincial executive authority, and the allocation for health services is then determined by the provincial executive authority. So now we've been concerned, deeply concerned by lack of allocation for priority areas. It is for that reason that we have established non-negotiables. And in the list of non-negotiables, we identify priority areas, but we also look at the guidelines, policies that should be implemented. And we have established a monitoring and tracking mechanism to establish whether indeed provinces do allocate. And we track the expenditure. And this is probably one thing that I think you'd need to have as an oversight committee, so that you can see what the allocations are. For mental health, we do have in the annual performance plan a budget line for mental health, but that on its own is not enough to guarantee allocations at provincial level, because it's a different process altogether. But I would like to use the non-negotiables as a tool that has been implemented recently, that I think honorable members should take interest in, because it's a very powerful tool. It's a powerful tool to check whether maternal and child health is allocated for all the programs, all the priority programs, including non-communicable diseases. The second chair is about funding that is allocated for revitalization and rehabilitation of our institutions. Professor Melfreman was just showing me one facility. We know of a few others. And it's true that mental health services, particularly the designated institutions, which are prescribed in law actually, have not received attention. But we also know of abuse of funds in provinces, for instance. You might be aware of the mental health facility that was supposed to have been built in Northern Cape, for which we've spent significant amount of money. And unfortunately, it's a very bad example of a mental institution where money has been significantly wasted. But we also know of a facility in Limpopo that was also neglected. Just after we appointed the CEO, she turned things around, she fixed the facility. It's also about management. So for every CEO that you've appointed, we actually need them to take issues in priority areas, whether it be maternal and child health, because we also have to recognize that coming up with policy and strategy by themselves is not enough, unless you have drivers in institutions. So we started the program of CEOs recently, and we strategically looked at areas that we would like to have addressed by all of them. Now we started with 103. And then we took a specific, all CEOs in Limpopo, took them through the program. And for all of them, we're saying to them, tell us, what is it that you do in 100 days? Now, if mental health is in a list of things that have to be addressed in those institutions in 100 days, we'd like to see the plan. Now, for the first cohort that we took, it was quite interesting to see what the outcome of the training program and in action was. Now, some of them have reported back, and we're now doing an analysis of what they said they were going to do in 100 days. And for us, it's a very important step, because this is a tool because they can also tell us if there are resource constraints and whether they've got delegations or not, because it also doesn't help if we have a beautiful program and at facility level CEOs do not have delegations. It doesn't matter what training you provide if they can't appoint basic staff, if they can't employ, because we'd like delegations to go further for them to employ certain categories of personnel. But in a structured manner, because our rights and tools is telling us what the norms and standards for staffing should be for different levels of facilities. Because you see, and I'd like to comment on this, WHO has come up with a model previously of seeing what a staffing population ratio is. And he said that's not a very useful measure, because what it tells you is that you need one psychiatrist per 1,000 population. But in essence, it doesn't tell you what the workload is, it doesn't tell you what the burden of disease is, it doesn't tell you what the catchment population is. So they've gone back to revise the tool. And we've just done that assessment in different levels of care, and we can tell you now in South Africa that this is the norm. And based on the norm, we're saying every single facility must comply with that norm. Meaning there's no facility that can give excuses. But what it will do, it will also help us to ensure that there's fair distribution of human resources, because in some instances one institution may have an oversupply of healthcare workers when another facility is undersupplied. So now this normative work that you just done, in fact the team finished yesterday, to conclude, we brought all experts in the country in different fields and different specialties and occupational areas to say, come tell us, if you're a radiographer or if you're an occupational health facility, what should the workload be in a facility and what should the services be? Because it's in instances where you say in a clinic of this size, it is not possible to employ all different categories. So the question then is, where should people access their services? So it's sort of a model that we look at. That's the first. Secondly, what should the referral mechanism be? And we're also looking at it from the context of, if people can access services within the private sector, what should be the contracting model? And we're doing this based on the GPs, but we look at all other categories of health workers. So Chair, this is an integrated approach that we're following that should bring services and your human resource planning together. Because on one hand, and this is what has happened over the years, we'll have a guideline and a policy is published, but we've not planned and integrated in an integrated manner how it should unfold. Because frankly, I can tell you here that for every single specialty area, if you talk to a cardiologist, he'll tell you that I need this type of people at district level in a facility. For psychiatry, you'll have the same thing. For diabetes, you'll have the same. So we are pushing for an integrated approach, because you need a critical mass of health professionals that can provide a service. Now if we organize our services, you know, programmatically, in a non-integrated manner, in a fragmented manner, it eats up resources. Because for each area it means you must pull in, you must, depending on who makes the loudest noise. I mean, we've seen how HIV it has also drawn resources away. Nurses left the service, they joined PEPFA, they joined different programs. Now that PEPFA is closing down, you know, we have a government to take over those services, which are run in communities and so on. So, in this integrated manner, you can on one hand move resources in one way, and then when you go to facilities, there are no resources. So, the integrated approach is the way to go. But you also have to look at where resources are going. And we are saying, with the non-negotiables, we're going to hold provinces to account. Now we check this. The in our National Health Council, every MEC and HOD have to say, why is allocation for a particular budget line low?
and or why are they spending? Why are the spending patterns so poor? So it's sort of mechanisms that we've put in place ourselves to ensure that that happens, and it's going to cut across different areas. So I thought I should give that overview. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll try and give you as rational and sane answers as possible within my constraints of being a mental health care practitioner. Excuse me if it looked like I wasn't concentrating when you were asking the question. I was rummaging through these papers, but I was trying to look for a piece of paper which I didn't find, which actually got all the hospitals, psychiatric hospitals that are either under revitalization or plans for revitalization and what space they had. So I can find that and distribute that to you. Okay. There were a lot of questions around voluntary and involuntary, when can you take a person in and when can't you and so on. And I think that the Act is actually fairly clear on this, although it doesn't need examination and decisions made by what we call mental health care practitioners. Chapter 5 is around voluntary assisted and involuntary mental health care. It starts by saying, a mental health care user who submits voluntarily to a health establishment for care, treatment and rehabilitation services is entitled to appropriate care, treatment and rehabilitation services or to be referred to an appropriate health establishment. So, in other words, if you have identified that you have a mental health problem, you can go to a facility and receive such care and treatment. Okay? You agree. Now, when we actually look at a developed country, the ratio of those who are voluntary to involuntary is usually about 80% to 20%. In other words, 80% of people who get mental health care come because they've identified a problem, come early enough, and get their care. In South Africa, it's probably the other way around. Okay. That 80% of people who we treat are involuntary. In other words, they haven't identified a problem, or others haven't identified a problem, and they haven't been brought for care. Okay. And they haven't agreed to care. So we landed up in a situation where we have these high numbers of involuntary people, but on what criteria do we take them in? It says here that a mental health care user must be provided with care, treatment and rehabilitation services without his or her consent at a health establishment on an outpatient or inpatient basis if, okay, an application is made, blah, blah, blah. At the time of making the application, there's reasonable belief that the mental health care user has a mental illness of such a nature that the user is likely to inflict serious harm to him or herself or others, or care, treatment and rehabilitation of the user is necessary for the protection of the financial interests or reputation of the user. And at the time of the okay, that those basically are the criteria for where you can treat somebody without their consent. They then have to be seen by two mental health care practitioners who have to assess whether they meet the criteria or not. Firstly, they've got to be mentally ill, and then they've got to meet these other criteria. So it can't be used for vagrants who are really a social development problem. They don't have a mental illness as such. Okay, so we can't use this act to just go around picking up people who are on the streets. But we can if they are mentally ill to such a degree that they are likely to inflict serious harm to self or others. So the kind of examples that people give in about somebody raping somebody else and so on, that's clear harm. If they've got a mental illness, you can go pick them up, you can go and get them a test, you can go and put them in for 72-hour assessment while you do a proper and thorough evaluation of the person's condition. So there are checks and balances on both sides, both to make sure that people who need care treatment but do not go to get it actually do get it, but at the same time, we don't just go picking up people who aren't mentally ill or who do not meet other criteria, say you're mentally ill, and take away their liberty and their rights. So I believe, in my view, there's fairly good balance in the legislation, and I urge people to actually look at it, because it then goes into the whole processes of how you admit such a person in those circumstances. I also urge you to look at some of the World Health Organization documents around this, where they are very, very strong on not just going around and picking up people and taking liberty away, but there are reasons, criteria, where
there are two provisions, two different pieces of legislation, this law and the National Health Act. Of course, the National Health Act makes provisions for people to which it open consent is given. But for people with incapacity, mental incapacity, or those who are not of majority age, the law is what the provision should be. For instance, in this particular act, Chapter 5 and Section 26 allows for people to be treated without consent, and as well as the rule of different members, for instance, of the family. It states who should provide such consent. So I would like to say that we should consider instances where the law does is enabling, that we rely on those provisions. But we are of course mindful of the fact that the Constitution is sort of a supreme law, and that people should not just be treated anyhow. But in the instance where people do need treatment and we cannot get consent, there are specific provisions. I thought I needed to raise that.
Thanks, TJ. Okay. The next question, I think, was around the 75% of people who need care but don't get it. This was established in the prevalence study that I was talking about, which established that 16.5% of people have mental disorders. They also asked those people, are you getting care and treatment? Have you ever received care and treatment in the study? And it was through that process that it was established that three-quarters of people who, through the diagnostic criteria, met a diagnosis of mental illness, were not getting treatment. And I think what I was trying to emphasize in this presentation is that 75 are very worrying for me. Okay? And that what we have to do is try to see how we assist that group, because the majority of them are of this common mental disorder, the depressions, the anxieties, the substance abuse, and so on. Which, by the way, let me answer your question. There's no differences in provinces. In fact, the amount is not significantly different between provinces. Okay. So how do we get to them? You know, some suggestions have been made by honourable members, such as support groups, counselling services, increasing in the counselling for Chichizeta in terms of victims. I mean, a lot of these people probably are, as you say, victims of woman abuse and gender abuse and so on. So we do need to look at the avenues of how do we improve our preventive services as well as our counselling services so that people actually can get the treatment that they deserve. And similarly, I think the question with the HIV, it is fine to talk about pre- and post-counseling, but if we're absolutely honest, it's mainly pre-test information and post-test information rather than psychological counseling as such. So I do think that a number of those people could really benefit from a couple more sessions to actually just work through what does it mean to live with HIV? What does it mean in my life? And it's not an easy thing to get such a categorization. You're now HIV positive. What does it mean for you? How is it going to change your life? What is it going to mean for your relationships in the future, for your intimate relationships? How are you going to live with this? And I think that for many people, it's a very difficult thing to do. And I think that we're not careful enough with helping people through this. And that's partly why we get this very, very high level of people with HIV who've also got mental health problems. Okay. Just as a side up, in the period when I wasn't working with the Department of Health, I actually did a study which showed this relationship, and then I worked with the World Health Organization in developing manuals on how to deal with this situation. And we have manuals on, well, WHO has manuals on how to do counseling, how to run support groups, what medications to give, et cetera, et cetera. And those are available to people, and we probably need to use them more in our own situation. There was the issue of property. I'm not sure that I quite remember the question, but certainly the act only kicks in when
say people have got property over a certain amount. Under a certain amount, it gets administered in a slightly different way. So again, refer to the Act, I think. But what we are saying is that people who can't give informed consent to care, many of them also can't have good control over their properties, and somebody else has to administer it for them. Something like bipolar disorder, people get manic, and they go and they buy, I had a case where clients mortgaged their house and bought a Ferrari when they were on a manic phase, because people get excited, and they go into irrational things. So somebody administering their property would have stopped that from happening.
Maybe to add that the administrator would only be appointed by a court of law, by the master of the court. They're not, the people cannot assume that responsibility. It's the provisions are very specific just to protect the interests of individuals, that the master of the court should appoint the administrator, who should then, oversee the interests of people who have mental incapacity.
Thanks, Eiji. Nutrition and mental illness, yes. This is one of those outside-in stories in a very graphic sense, because, yes, what people eat is going to affect the development of the child from both physical and mental points of view. And, yes, it is one of those situations where I'm saying, yes, let's improve the outside. Let's make sure that people do have access to proper nutrition. And I think things like the social grants and so on and so are all part of trying to improve the poverty situation so that when people do have children, they are nourished enough to be able to not give birth to people with perhaps intellectual disabilities. And I think maybe I could also just answer the iodine question there too. I think you are aware that most of the salt in South Africa is iodized, specifically for that reason. Now, one of the questions we've been getting in terms of our salt regulation around limiting the amount of salt, are we not going to then limit the iodine? But in fact, there have been studies done in Australia and elsewhere and linked to our thing. It's not going to be insufficient. There will be sufficient iodine even with our restrictions on the salt. So I don't think that's anything to worry about.
Maybe the one that should be a concern is the folic acid supplementation in pregnancy, because it's used to prevent a neural tube defect in children. These are the congenital abnormalities that can be prevented. So things like folic acid supplementation, we just have to ensure that when women are given their supplementation, iron, folic acid should also be included. Maybe that should be the area of concern, I think.
The issue of OSD for psychiatric nursing is currently being looked at. I can't say anything more. I'm not sure if DG wants to say anything more. But
we've actually done an OSD review. It's something that I would imagine OSD was something that was well intended but has had bad consequences. And we've just had that OSD report, and after a review, based on the review, we're going to look at how we take corrective action. And the psychiatric nurses are not just the only group, the midwives, infection control nurses, I mean, in the key strategic areas where we're supposed to be implementing policy. That's where we've seen problems of nurses moving and shifting away from the key strategic areas. So with the review, I'm hoping that we'll take corrective action.
Chair, I see that 1 o'clock is coming up fast, so I don't want to choose questions, but just getting back to the facility issue, the person was talking about Bobalong. Bobalong is currently being built as a psychiatric hospital, but what was very interesting for me there is that they planned for a very big hospital, for a very big psychiatric hospital, much, much bigger than the one we've got now. But they've got almost nothing for patients in Northwest in the community. So I went there and I said, no, instead of building this size hospital, cut down your number of beds and build half their houses in your community. And they saw the logic. logic of that, and it seems to be shifting, so that it's a real opportunity because the money was already allocated. And we said, not that we don't need hospital, but let's look at the province and see where we need facilities.
You had mentioned that you also told them that it was contrary to habitual policy, which is because that was the basis on which we reversed the doctor's decision. The WHO resolution actually encourages community-based care. So we made Northwest comply with the resolution that we've been part of as a country.
In terms of study on the impact of liberation politics, I don't know that there's been a study per se. There's been a lot of studies that have looked at the impacts of personal trauma and seeing trauma that took place during that time. And there's a lot of research around that, but I don't think quite what you were asking about. Okay, 5 provinces don't have child and adolescent. Yes, this is a problem. But as I say, in terms of our school health services, we're trying to see what we can do about this. But also, Department of Basic Education does employ educational psychologists, and some of the people that need assistance do get picked up through that system. But it is a problem, and we want to see what we can do about that in those provinces. We hear this problem the same way as you do. The pre-state problem, pre-state is also either in the process of rebite or is on the list for to be revitalized very soon. So hopefully the problem that you were seeing there will be dealt with.
When I was there, the money was budgeted for, but apparently the plan has been changing annually. So the hospital is not in the pipeline. That's what I was told by management.
Yeah, about Free State, unfortunately, is a sad story. In that they have a huge, huge crisis. We even asked with the other committee, the opposition committee, to ask that they intervene. They asked Treasurer to specifically intervene because they had actually withheld some of the funds because of the crisis they were having in the province as a whole, and they were redirecting funds and also withholding payment. And they held back some of the infrastructure projects. As of last week, there was a special meeting of some of the select committees, treasury, and they invited our team to be part of that team. I'm just saying it's a much bigger problem than just this specific hospital.
Yes. Sorry, because I'm trying to think too fast, I'm getting nothing now. Things like the young person in Cochranet not getting referral is a real problem for us because they should have those services in place for referral within the province. And if the person isn't, the person that has been described seems to me to not be a candidate for care at that level. It seems like somebody with more specialization is needed, and that does mean that referral is necessary. But provinces should have the referral protocols as to where the person should be referred to, and we can look at what that case was and why it was that a person wasn't referred appropriately and where they got stuck and so on. Maybe also to pick up on the issue of when the police should be transporting and when ambulances should be and when cars and so on. The Act is also quite specific about when the police can be used for transportation, Section 40 of the Act. But they are very adamant that they're not a transporter. They can only be used in particular circumstances where the person is displaying such characteristics that the health department cannot intervene. And a community member can also call the police if a person is displaying activities that are of mental illness and danger, and they are then obliged to pick up that person and take them for an assessment to the nearest health facility. If a person is being carried in an ambulance and they are being disruptive, then they should be sedated. And there are regulations around this in the that are regulation to the Mental Health Care Act. And again, we can have, let you have a copy of those regulations. I'm not going to do the Nayorpe thing. Dali, you want to? Okay.
Mel should have just mentioned that there's actually an interministerial committee that is chaired by the Minister of Social Development. And at this meeting, they have specifically asked, you know, because there was that area presentation by NSF and the question about the communities and access to ARVs. It's a real concern. And I'm raising that because when we had this interministerial committee, they actually mentioned that they're still efferent and they mix it with rat poison and other substances of abuse, you know, human rights and others. And that our view and the request at the time was that we needed to see whether within the medicine's law we can outlaw this. Now our point is that all statutes 7 and 8 are actually banned substances. They're not supposed to be accessed. But of course they're legally obtainable. And the concern is you can't outlaw severance as an ARV, but we probably can look at provisions whereby if it's used in that form, then that, you know, there should be a banned substance. And the Medicines Control Council will be meeting next week specifically to look at that. And I thought it was necessary to mention this because it's a real societal problem.
But also,
I'm not a mother, the rest of them.
Thank you very much.